Hello, I'm Dr. Nick Pennings, Chair and Associate Professor of Family Medicine at the Campbell University School of Osteopathic Medicine, and I'm here today with Dr. Joynita Nicholson, a clinical expert and pioneer in bariatric medicine from Richmond, Virginia, who is board certified in obesity medicine and family medicine with fellowship designation in obesity medicine. Today, we're going to review the concept of obesity as a chronic disease and why it's vital for primary care clinicians to take a more active role in addressing it as early as possible. So I'm going to start with the concept of obesity as a chronic disease. So Dr. Nicholson, can you elaborate on the concept of obesity as a serious chronic illness and why it's important for primary care clinicians to know?
Yes. Nick, you probably remember in 2013, the American Medical Association declared obesity as a disease. And we have learned that it is not an acute illness like a common cold that develops suddenly, but it's rather, you know, a relapsing chronic neuroendocrine and behavioral disease that has many causes and requires long-term and lifelong intervention. And according to the CDC, when they define the body mass index over 30 kilograms per meter squared to be what obesity is classified as, we see that this has continued to increase in its prevalence, and especially even more after the COVID pandemic. And it's expected that instead of the 42% of the adult population that is currently impacted by obesity, it is increasing to about 50%. In 2030 is what is projected. And it impacts all ages, all genders, all socioeconomical backgrounds, and ethnicities. Obesity impacts every organ system in the human body and is associated with several hundred chronic medical conditions, including arthritis, depression, certain cancers, and even epidemics, such as the diabetes, cardiovascular disease, stroke, and the COVID-19 pandemic. And it's now the most common medical problem that the primary care physicians are seeing chronically. It puts individuals at increased health risk for other chronic diseases and increases all-cause mortality. Yet it's often under-recognized, under-diagnosed, and under-treated, which is why we're here today. And it's important for the primary care clinicians to know this because we can partner with the patients and help them to identify this disease and its associated medical conditions early, and then help them create a customized, multidisciplinary plan to reduce the excess weight and improve the body composition of the patient, which can result in improvement of every associated illness and improve the overall health and wellness of the patient.
And I think a couple things that you point out there is that, you know, it is on the rise. It continues to be on the rise. The current treatments or the previous treatments for obesity have really not been fully utilized in primary care and really need to be, because I think that's the direction that we need to go in, because it's such a prevalent disease. So mm-hmm. What do you think are some of those challenges around for primary care physicians to not be treating this?
Well, for one, it starts with our medical education. And still today, we find that there's no course in obesity medicine at the medical educational level. That is something that we need to advocate a little bit stronger. I know there's a lot of information that we cover in medical school, but certainly we are learning, because this is at the root of a lot of the other chronic illnesses, that we must emphasize this more, even at that level. And then that, I believe, will translate forward into our practices. And so, Nick, I do have some questions that we'd like to hear your expertise on. And your question is, what are some of the key adiposity-related diseases and conditions that are associated with obesity? We made reference to, there are hundreds of them. Now, if you can just share what a few of them are, that would be wonderful for our listeners.
And certainly, as you alluded to, there are lots of diseases associated with obesity. It's estimated there's some 237 diseases associated with obesity. And as you mentioned, that COVID pandemic really showed the vulnerability of patients with obesity to certain illnesses like COVID, and what they had a higher morbidity and mortality rate associated with obesity. So that's, I think that's a very scary threat to individual health. But there are also some more common and severe diseases that we encounter on a daily basis. At the top of the list, I would put is diabetes. Diabetes is something that is directly associated with weight, particularly associated with the development of unhealthy fat in the body, that visceral fat, that central abdominal fat, the fat that builds up around the heart and other areas or organs of the body. These are really key factors in the development of diabetes. We also see it in the development of cardiovascular disease, and I would lump metabolic syndrome in there as well because they really go together. Along with diabetes, you see hyperinsulinemia, you see insulin resistance, you see inflammatory changes which promote atherosclerosis and cardiovascular disease. You also see other unhealthy effects in the body that are occurring and contributing to blood pressure and other health conditions. So we see a lot of different issues that are occurring around this. We see an increased risk of cancer, and that's something that's not often thought about with respect to obesity, particularly things like esophageal cancer or breast cancer, endometrial cancer. We see conditions like obstructive sleep apnea and osteoarthritis. These are other things that are related just to the mass effect that can happen with obesity. So let me ask you, how do some of the pathophysiologic changes of obesity and weight gain contribute to the difficulties with the long-term management of this disease?
Well, Nick, you also recall, because you've been practicing obesity medicine for many years, as I have, that back in the 1930s, now we weren't existing then, but back in the 1930s, physicians stigmatized people with obesity and believed that their excess weight was caused by their lack of willpower. And we'd say things like, just push back from the table, move more, put the fork down, eat less, you know, and we really thought that was the treatment for patients with obesity. And now we know that it's so much more than that. It's so much more than, you know, just thinking patients don't have discipline to eat a healthy diet, or that they're lazy and they're just not moving as much as they need to, and that it's purely a lifestyle choice. We know now, because it's been well studied, that when patients have obesity, it is not just a behavior problem, but it is a biology problem. We know that it is more than just a mindset, but it is a medical condition. We know that it is not simply a condition caused by lifestyle choice, but is rather a lifetime disease that requires lifetime and long intervention. We know this because it's been well studied, and it is a chronic, relapsing neuroendocrine and behavioral disorder. It's not just one of those, it's all of those, and it's influenced by age and epigenetics and genetics and obesogenic environments and weight positive medications. It's influenced by medical conditions and so many other contributing factors. It's a disease of excess energy that's stored in the body throughout in the form of what we refer to as fat. Yes, the three-letter word fat. But its true pathology is based on the size, the number, and the location of the enlarged fat cells, which we refer to as an adipocyte, and the associated detrimental metabolic consequences. And then this excess weight is driven by physiological pathways that regulate the energy balance that signals the activation and the inhibition of neurotransmitters and cause release of hormones that regulate hunger, satiety or fullness, appetite, and cravings. And although weight loss can be achieved with intervention, the majority of patients regain weight over the long term. And the reason for the weight regain after weight loss is related to both psychological and physiological mechanisms. And weight loss seems to result in a pronounced stimulation of the appetite and long-lasting fall in the basal and exercise-induced metabolic rates. And specifically, it's estimated that for each kilogram of lost weight, calorie expenditure decreases by about 20 to 30 kilocalories per day, whereas appetite increases about 100 kilocalories a day above the baseline prior to the weight loss. And so it's important for us, when patients have these metabolic adaptations, to partner with the patients and help them commit long term to making the changes that are necessary, so that we can help them change their health status, and also intervene with things like stress, which makes them resort to these old bad habits, and help them as well, to maintain healthy body weight priorities, because life gets busy and the priorities change. And we want to make sure that, once they achieve their goals, that they understand that they can't stop doing what they did to get there, but we must continue to do what our body needs to maintain that healthier status. And that, once again, this isn't something that is short term. This is a long term commitment and partnership with the physicians and the clinicians.
Yeah, and I often describe that to my patients as our bodies are designed to prevent starvation, not obesity. So what you describe was all those pathophysiologic mechanisms by which the body protects excess weight and resists that weight loss. And then, unfortunately, that turns into many of the diseases that we encounter.
Yes, and it's difficult, right? Because as I share with patients, on one hand, we were able to do this, and that, and we were able to achieve our goals. But then life changed, whether it was a job change, or now you're having to take care of an elderly parent, or there's a newborn in the household. There's something that changed that caused you to change and maybe revert to those bad habits. So it's important to understand what those habits are, so that we can have mechanisms in place to sustain the great success long term. Now, Nick, tell me a little bit about the societal factors that health care or let's see, a better way of saying this is, how do societal factors such as access to health care or socioeconomic status impact long term weight management?
And I think it begins with what you were just discussing, in that society in general doesn't view this as a disease and doesn't understand the pathophysiology of the disease. And so the perception is that this is a decision that people are making, and that is a huge consequence to being able to, or a huge challenge for us as clinicians to try to overcome, because patients come in with that bias and feeling like this is something that is just a matter of willpower. But I think if we look back over time, it's just kind of interesting to see that there was a time when having excess weight was a sign of wealth and success, that it was a matter of being able to afford food and be able to afford enough food to gain weight. That combined with a society that often engaged in much higher levels of physical labor, so you needed calories to be able to sustain yourself with the level of physical activity that was required just to survive. Now, in modern times, there's really been a shift that we have moved, where food has become a necessity to survive, and now it's really become a threat to our survival. Our food choices have changed dramatically with the agricultural revolution. We've been able to greatly increase productivity and access to food. In one sense, that's a great thing, but it's also resulted in a lot more processed foods, a lot more highly refined foods. We have a loss of genetic diversity of grains, and that may be having a negative impact on our health and our weight. Particularly with ultra-processed food that become readily available, they're cheap and easily accessible.
Yes, and life is so fast, Nick. It's interesting that when you don't have time to eat a nice, healthy, proper lunch because life was so fast, you didn't get a chance to prepare your food in advance before you left for the day. The options are, oh, buy this. You get, your soft drink. You get your unhealthy burger. You get your vegetable, your French fries, right? And so, and guess what? It's on sale today, and you can get it very fast, and you didn't have to prepare it yourself. So when we have such a fast-paced society and we have these unhealthy foods that are so readily available and quickly available so we can keep life going, it certainly makes it more difficult to do what we know is right to do for our health.
Yes, I talk to my patients. If you plan lunch at 11:55, you're going to go for fast food because that's all you have time for at the time. It really takes a more advanced planning. And when you're consuming those foods, you're going to consume more of them. Kevin Hall did a very nice study looking at ultra-processed foods versus foods that are not processed. And he create a very controlled environment where he looked at two groups. One was consuming ultra-processed foods, one was not, and they could eat as much as they want. And what they found was that the people that had the ultra-processed food ate more calories than those that had the lesser processed food. And it was a crossover study, so they saw the same thing when people switched their roles. So I think that is really was a very telling study. And unfortunately, what that turns into is particularly affecting socioeconomic disadvantaged populations that have limited access to these foods, that they live in the food swamps where you don't have grocery stores, but you have a half a dozen fast food places to choose from. And we're seeing obesity rates much higher in lower socioeconomic groups and those disadvantaged groups because they're turning to those foods that promote weight gain.
Yes, and I can identify with that because I now work in a rural community, and I'll tell you, there's one grocery store, there are two restaurants that are fast food, one is Bojangles and the other is Burger King, and it's attached to a gas station. And so the best fast food that I'm learning this community feels is available are located in gas stations. And so it's really interesting because that is a direct contrast to coming from a larger city where you have several options for healthier foods, you know, that are sometimes even vegan. I think when we're creating this personalized approach for our patients, it's so important to understand, you know, what do they have to work with in their society and not just assume that your resources in your society are theirs. But that is definitely an area that I think as clinicians, we have to continue to advocate for our patients and make sure that even in the grocery stores, you know, they have access to healthier foods at affordable prices. And gyms, right? Physical activity. Life is busier. Stress is at an all-time high. When COVID hit, a lot of gyms closed. Well, now they've reopened. But the question is, can everybody afford a gym? And if not, then how can we help patients also have the physical activity they need? Counseling, you know, for stress management. Can they afford it? Can they not afford it? And if not, then what are our options? So all of these things play a role in us learning our patients and trying to help them develop an individualized plan that they can be successful with long-term.
Yes, I think it's important to appreciate all those challenges because every population faces its own health challenges. And when you live in a food environment that promotes weight gain, it's really hard to lose weight and sustain that weight loss. But losing weight does have benefits. So what are some of the benefits that people can realize with a sustained weight loss?
Well, you know, it only takes 5 to 10% of the loss of weight from your initial body weight in order to start to see improvements of those over 236 medical conditions that you made reference to, the asthma, the diabetes, the cardiovascular disease. It only takes 5 to 10%. And so that is definitely something that we can help patients achieve. The question is, how long can we sustain it? That is our true challenge. The other thing is, if we can also monitor the body mass indices and we see an improvement of 2 units. So if they say, for instance, had a body mass index of 35 and now we get them down to a 33, we also have helped them to achieve an overall improvement in those 236 medical conditions. And here's yet another. If a patient can lose 1 to 2 pounds per week, and that's what we really encourage patients to set as a healthy goal for weight loss, because when you're losing 3 to 5 pounds per week, that's referred to as rapid weight loss. And with that, it's going to require your physician to actually pay closer attention to blood work, to your vital signs, and you'll need a closer follow-up with the doctor. But if we can just help them lose either 2 body mass unit indices or reduce it to that, if we can help them to lose 5 to 10% of their initial body weight, if we can help them as well to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week, we will see improvement of all those medical conditions. And then we need to help them maintain this as well as their energy and their physical mobility and their physical activity and things like their general mood and their sleep and their self-confidence will improve. And we can start to reduce the number of medications they use and the medical conditions that they have. And we will actually see improvements in their blood work, such as the A1C will reduce, the cholesterol levels seem to improve, lower C-reactive protein levels, liver function tests, kidney functioning are all witnessed, as well as improvement in the anthropometric measures such as the weight, the body mass index, the waist circumference and the neck circumference, as well as body fat. And patients then become very thrilled to look their best, to feel their best, and to live their best lives in a healthier state with a better quality of life.
Absolutely. And I think one of the interesting things about that statistics, the 5 to 10%, is it's important to recognize where is that 5 to 10% coming off of. And I think one of the reasons why it can have such a powerful effect on your health is that you tend to lose that visceral fat first, that there's a preferential loss early on in weight loss that really then translates into very significant health benefits.
Yes, yes. And what are some of the limitations, though, Nick, of relying solely on lifestyle changes for sustained weight loss?
And so lifestyle modification is really a cornerstone of obesity treatment. And so it is something that we never want to lose sight of, but it's also important to understand what the limitations are, that people typically will only lose about 5% of body weight with lifestyle modification. So while that can have great health benefits, it's not often what people are looking for in order to achieve. And you do see greater health benefits with higher levels of weight loss as you tend to increase the amount of pounds lost. You tend to see enhancements of those health benefits. But it is challenging. It's challenging to sustain with a lifestyle modification. And so weight gain regain is common. And that is really a frustration for patients. As patients lose weight, gain weight, lose weight, gain weight, they often blame themselves. There's a lot of self-judgment around that. There's a lot of societal judgment around that. And that really is a struggle for patients. And I think important to that is just understanding of why does that happen. And as you talked about with the physiology, that in that calorie-restricted state, when we start to cut our calories, we're going to be hungry. And hungry is not a good feeling. Mm-hmm. And so that's how the body works. And that makes you more vulnerable to that weight regain. And that is not just a short-term response. You know, many patients think that, and I think healthcare providers as well, once you lose the weight, you're done, and that weight loss is easy. And, you know, as an obesity medicine specialist, you know that it's the maintenance that's really the hard part. And there was really a beautiful study done by Simithrin that looked at the physiologic response to calorie restriction and that the hormonal adaptations to that. It was a study that looked over a, initially they put people on for a 10-week rapid weight loss program where they lost an average of 14% of their body weight. And they looked at those hunger hormones and satiety hormones that the body makes. And at the end of those 10 weeks, those hunger hormones were higher, those fullness hormones were lower. And then they looked at it again after a year of maintenance. And a year later, those hunger signals were still higher, those fullness signals were still lower, and the desire to eat and perceived hunger were even higher at the end of 62 weeks than they were at the end of 10 weeks. And I think that really, to me, was a landmark study that showed the physiologic challenges with weight loss. And so What are some of the things that we can do beyond lifestyle that have shown promise for long-term weight management?
I think we must first understand what is this lifestyle management or modification. I think we've done a great job making reference to it, but let's just zone in a little bit here. When we talk about the lifestyle modifications, we're referring to the nutritional therapy. We're referring to physical activity. We're referring to behavioral assessments and interventions. And when we start to talk about behavioral assessments and interventions, that includes things like sleep behavior or sleep hygiene, substance use, including caffeine, nicotine. We have to include CBD and marijuana now because it's legal in some states and more highly used. We have to include things like alcohol consumption. And we didn't mention before, but I'd like to throw it in, and this probably would go under nutritional, sugar-sweetened beverages. Over 50% of our calories come from sugar-sweetened beverages. And some of my patients believe that just because they're drinking their juice, they're getting their water in. Just because they're drinking something wet like lemonade, they're getting their water in. But I try to emphasize, you might get water in with those things, but you also get calories that you didn't want or need. You also get preservatives and other ingredients that we really don't know long term how it might impact you. So it's important to make sure when we are making reference to telling patients to please make sure you stay hydrated, that we specify with water. We want them to use water because our bodies are made up of water. Over 80% of our cells do require it. And so we need water. So when we look at the lifestyle modifications, it's important to keep in mind, it's not just what they're eating, but it's what they're eating, it's their physical activity, and it's this behavioral component, which could include stress management, as well as identifying eating disorders, which we didn't mention yet. And other mental health diseases like anxiety, depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, and the medications that come along with that. So once we understand lifestyle modifications and we've really done a deep dive with the patient to understand where their health is there, we nowadays, and I roll my hands a little because it's so exciting to see that we have medications available that can now help with weight loss. And in addition to medications, more studies are coming out about making sure that we have a healthy gut, right? Make sure that our gut microbiome is healthy. And so there are certain foods, like your fermented foods and the like, and probiotics that are now being recommended. Although there are not a lot of studies for humans that have shown great success, there is great promise in the studies they've performed on animals and just the clinical experience and results, positive results we're seeing. And then thirdly, would be, or this, I'm sorry, finally would be the surgical approach. That is still a very real and very much so effective approach to helping patients with weight management. But it's just so wonderful that now we have more medications, we have more knowledge, and we have more surgical approaches that we can offer patients so that long term we can create this individualized plan with them and help them to not only attain their immediate goals, but to sustain their long-term success.
That's very exciting. There's lots of different opportunities. This is a great field to be a part of, and a very exciting to see what's happening in this space.
Yes, so before we finish, do you have any takeaways for our listeners, Nick?
Well, I think this has been a great discussion. I think that it's important that people take from this that obesity is a long-term problem and that it needs chronic treatment. I think of it in the same context as diabetes or hypertension, where lifestyle modification is a foundational part of the management, but also it's a long-term problem that, for example, if you're taking a blood pressure medication, if you stop that medication, your blood pressure goes up because it's a chronic disease. And we see that same chronicity in obesity. I also hope that people take away from this that there is a physiologic response to a negative energy balance, that when we eat less and when we do more, it's going to create a sense of hunger, which is difficult to sustain. And because of that, that weight regain is a challenge that we'll all face when we're trying to help our patients lose weight. And the more weight you have to lose, the stronger this response is. So when lifestyle modification is just not enough, then additional measures are required. So we hope you find this information helpful. To obtain your CME credit, please visit theprimed.com and complete a short post assessment. If you listen to this podcast on another platform, please refer to the episode description where there's a direct link to the activity page on primed.com for claiming CME credit. Thank you so much for listening to this PrimeMed podcast, and have a great day.
Thank you, Nick.